Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Joins us for the weekly update here at JM and the AM. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. I think we'll have to do yes and no answers in order to cover everything that has happened.
Hey, I sometimes try that, but not everybody cooperates. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Very good. Let's start with what I guess is most important. What can you tell us about the physical and mental health of Gilad Shalit?
Well, everybody saw that he was able to walk himself. He was physically appeared to be sound. But I've heard that in the debriefing and in the discussions with his family and since then, and he is getting both mental counseling and physical counseling, that his the period in incarceration by Hamas was, aside from the isolation, and that is something that often won't show up till much later. And you notice that even in the interview with the Egyptians, which was totally inappropriate, and in violation of the understandings that they had, you could see that he was not able to articulate. He was in shock still, sitting there with Hamas guys leaning over his shoulders. But the family says that the story will come out, that he suffered much more than would appear by the physical appearance of somebody who was 19 years old when he went in and 25 when he came out.
And the enemy, so to speak, has already made public statements about how well he was treated, etc. They have no choice but to do that, right? We're never going to get an honest assessment.
As somebody pointed out, just look at the condition of those who were returned by Israel, many of them with extended stomachs, and look at the condition that he came back frail and certainly undernourished.
Yeah, that's for sure. Why couldn't this deal have been made years ago? We had been tossing around the idea the media and, of course, the prime minister's office, even 5 years ago, always spoke of this, very lopsided deal, 1,000 for 1. Why couldn't it have been done back then?
Well, first of all, you make an important point that this was, I think, originally Olmert's negotiations. And if we look even earlier at all of the exchanges that took place and the history of lopsided exchanges, even for people or soldiers who are not alive, but for the principle that we do everything possible to get back every soldier, and that is a pledge, that an understanding between the IDF and its soldiers. But there were a confluence of factors. One, I think the changes in Egypt enabled them to have more leverage, perhaps, with Hamas. I think Hamas, looking at the changes in the area and particularly the developments in Syria and the concern they had that they're going to have to leave once Assad falls and they will need another place to go, and as long as they're holding Shalit, they knew that was not going to be possible in a country, let's say, like Egypt or Jordan, where there are late rumors that they may go to reestablish their headquarters in Amman after being driven out of there 10 years ago. I think that that there were a number of factors that relate to the internal situation between Hamas and Fatah, meaning the desire to draw attention away from Abbas because of his move towards unilateral declaration, which they thought might get him favorable reviews amongst the Palestinian people, although it's much less so than I think many assume, and that they wanted to counter, take the attention away, become the focal point.
But am I right or wrong that through this whole process, no one really ever expected Abbas to be able to get Shalit released?
But it wasn't because of Shalit, about his achieving Shalit's release. It was about his getting the attention for what he was doing at unilateral declaration and, gaining some degree of popularity as a leader finally, because he had always been seen as a very weak, corrupt leader.
So they've one-upped him, so to speak.
Exactly.
And is this a circumstance that could only have happened because of all these events that are going on in October of 2011, or was there a potential to make this deal another time?
It's a good question, and we won't know because can't test it. But there were negotiations going on all the time. The Germans, others intervened. I had some involvement to seek some of parts of this close-up. So there were always ongoing discussions and efforts. The Egyptians, Mubarak, tried many times. The relationship between Egypt and Hamas, especially because of the Muslim Brotherhood's role, is different than it was during the Mubarak years. And perhaps that gave him a little bit more of an entree. But I think if we look at the internal situation and the interests of Hamas at this point, whether they felt Shalit would be a diminishing return on holding him, as opposed to the boost they got in standing amongst the Palestinian people and because of the worldwide attention that they were able to garner.
What do you say to those who, especially those thousands of miles away from Israel, who actively make known their opinion that this was a terrible deal for Israel?
Look, nobody thinks this is a great deal when you have to give up people that you know there will be a significant percentage of them who will be recidivists, who will again engage in terror. These people were responsible perhaps for 500 to 600 deaths, many attacks, many of them serving multiple life sentences. So nobody is happy about the return of it. They did cherry pick them. They did not release many of the high profile people that the Hamas had originally been demanding. But my answer is, if it was your brother or your son, if you know that every soldier going into service has to know that he will be protected and that whatever needs to be done. Now, I can't say that, you know, people are going to recommend, and there were serious people who have come out against the deal. It's a decision I would never have to make, want to have to make, and I would never want to be prime minister, not for 10 seconds, because the, you know, a prime minister of Israel, as Rabin once told me when I got into a discussion with him about this, and once with Sharon as well, about the, what they have to face. You know, he said to me, the president of the United States can send boys to war. He doesn't have to see their families every day.
Right. Right.
The prime minister of Israel walks out of his office. He sees the Shalits every morning.
Right.
Every day they met with him every month. It's a constant issue with them. And you know all their relatives. You know the families of the boys that they sent into war. It's not, you know, a distant relationship. So people have to think and put themselves in their shoes and think about, what does it mean if you join Shvuyim, you have an opportunity, what is the price you pay for?
Right. So essentially, as you view the situation, all the responses, so to speak, are acceptable, meaning the way that the Shalits reacted, obviously, you know, like you said, what wouldn't we do for our own family member? The way that family members of those who've been murdered over the years reacted, you would also say was legitimate, correct?
Absolutely.
Although it was distressing to see that, you know, one family was ready to move right out of Israel because of it, but
I wouldn't take that as a guide to it. I mean, they moved to other times, but I certainly, and I know members of the family, and I remember, you know, of course, the extreme tragedy of their family. If you remember, the father was the one who told the children, and he's yelling "Abba, Abba" at Sbarro's.
Right.
He told them to say the Shema.
Right.
Immediately afterwards, they died, and the. So I don't think you can ever second guess these people. I don't think you can hold them in judgment. Look, nobody can feel light about this. The prime minister can't feel easy about it. What's going to happen the first time? God forbid one of these guys tries a terrorist attack. Hopefully, he doesn't succeed. But you know that there will be whatever political gains it got from the immediate issue isn't going to be wiped out in the aftermath of God forbid, an attack.
Do you get the feeling that, the media in Israel generally is not kind to the prime minister? You know that.
That's for sure.
Do you think there was some element, I'm not trying to be cynical here, I'm trying to, you know, talk about each aspect of this. Is it possible that he thought that if he went ahead and made this deal, that one of the small fringe benefits down the road would be a kinder media to him, and never expected the media to then change their mind and all of a sudden focus on the, you know, how horrible the deal was?
I don't think that prime ministers can make decisions. I'm not that cynical that they do it, and especially in a case like this. You know, we all wrote, we set up GiladGreetings.org together with people in New Jersey. We carried on the campaign for him. I mean, there was no Jew who, in every shul, everywhere, people said Mishaberach, they said Tehillim for him, they did other things. So we all tried to achieve the same end. The question was only the price that they were willing to pay. And if the head of the Mossad, the head of the Shin Bet approved this deal, very significant people like Moshe Arends and Moshe Yaalon, Bogi Yaalon, Deputy Prime Minister, who said, you know, that my heart is saying yes and my head is saying no, and
right.
he voted against it.
Right.
These are serious people, and it's not a simple decision. There's no right and wrong or yes and no. You have to look at the totality. Just put yourself in the position of the Prime Minister and see what you would do.
The head of the Shabak actually was for the deal in the end, if I think I read that.
Yeah.
He was for the
and
deal.
And the Mossad.
And the head of the Mossad. What do you do now, though, with the way the enemy is reacting? Okay, it's open season on Israeli soldiers. And they say this publicly. We're going to go kidnap more.
Right. That's exactly what they say, and we have to show what they are, who they are, and their responses to it. So you know, the temporary euphoria, and we have to make sure that Hamas remains isolated, remains on the terrorist list, that this doesn't become a key to open other doors for them. So far it hasn't, and I think both the government of Israel, we, many others, the United States, have been working to make sure that that is not the case. But you know that there will be plenty who are just chomping at the bit to run in and start dealing with Hamas.
It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the morning radio program, heard on listener-sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope. We're around the world on the web, jmnam.org. What about the students, the young people in Israel who are telling the Prime Minister, don't trade us for terrorists? Is that simply, you know, again, something that has to be said and has to be felt? It's sort of like we have a lot of different things being juggled at the same time, you know what I mean? In terms of reaction, in terms of the way people need to deal with this. This is the appropriate thing for a potential soldier to say, right?
It's a very courageous thing for them to say, but I don't know if, God forbid, they were in the circumstance that that's what they would say.
Right. Tell me about that interview. I would think 25 years ago, Israel would either have made sure that that interview after Shalit was released or was as he was about to be released would never have taken place.
They didn't know about it. They were blindsided.
I understand that. It's, I don't know. Am I crazy? It seems to me that
I can't answer you.
That's a yes or no. Huh? It seems to me that the blindsided stuff didn't happen decades ago. Am I right?
No. They had no control. They had no ability to intervene at that point because he wasn't in their hands. He was still in Egyptian/Hamas hands, and they claim that, you know, it was meant to be a positive gesture and show the people of Egypt, but they were blindsided. There's nothing you can't.
Nothing you can do about it. And the Prime Minister, I guess, or whoever from the Prime Minister's office expressed their objection to it.
They were not happy about it.
Right. And it was basically just a ratings grabber as a payback to Egypt for intervening, I guess, right? That's what it seems like to me. That they would get the exclusive, so to speak. I mean, it was Egyptian state television, right?
Right.
So I guess
Egyptian state television, and I don't know.
So what simply part
they get for it.
Yeah, simply
not
part
very
of
much.
Part of the deal, I guess. Right. You know, I mean, this is the thing that ends up.
But it wasn't negotiated as part of the deal, but Egypt did play an important role in this and took advantage of the opportunity. I don't know why it does. I mean, if it helps their ratings, it's for 30 seconds.
Right. And also, you know, Barghouti seemed so important to them. At least that's what it sounded like for the last couple of years. You know, that Barghouti's really. So, I mean, would they have gone for a 400-plus Barghouti deal as opposed to the, you know, 1,027 deal? Or he was not as important as I think?
Well, I'm not sure all of them want him out because he could be competition. He could become a leader. Everybody says, but often they're very good leaders while they're in prison and away from the people, and once they're exposed, it doesn't work so well.
Right.
But they might have seen him as potential competition and therefore ready to yield on him as opposed to some of the others.
Right. And how did we get to this number? And I don't mean specific 1,027, but how do you get to 1,000? Is that because years ago Israel had already agreed to deals in the 400 or 500s?
They yielded hundreds of people for dead people,
right?
Soldiers,
right?
So, but Olmert, I think, established the framework for this deal, and I think they were just filling in the details, negotiating.
Right.
There were many that Israel wouldn't agree to.
Right, completely against your theory of negotiating, setting the standard way too high.
This is way too high.
I mean, if Olmert would have started 100,
you're ready now that they are. Well, but it wasn't Olmert. There were trades before that were
right.
equally high.
Right. So yeah,
that's right. Now they're talking about, Barack and others have talked about setting a new paradigm, setting new measures. We have to change the rules for negotiations.
What about changing the rules in terms of death penalty in Israel?
That's something people are talking about. But many people say that maybe they shouldn't be taking so many prisoners when you're dealing with guys who are carrying out acts like this. But Israel, you know, is governed by a rule of law and by humanitarian considerations. But I think that those who carry out the kind of vicious and unjustified and, you know, inhumane attacks as these people did, these were not freedom fighters. This is, you know, not people befetted. And I believe that many of them, I once witnessed an exchange. I was invited to come to the Syrian border where they did an exchange. And I saw that they took these Syrian prisoners, some of whom had bandages and, you know, working crutches, as they returned, and you could hear this, you could see the Syrians applauding as they came over. And as soon as they got to the top of the hill, they literally lifted them and threw them into trucks. And you can be sure that many of these guys are being subjected to Hamas interrogation and limitations.
Unbelievable. You think Israeli intelligence is going to learn a lot from Shalit, or likely because of the circumstances, not much?
Well, he was isolated. There wasn't much that he could have known. They could hear some of the things about whether he was moved around and things like that, but there isn't that much, I think, that of hard intelligence that they can learn from him.
Bottom line is that this situation basically stumped everybody. Political leader, cabinet member, rabbis.
Everybody.
I mean, I'm sure people...
But many countries were involved. I mean, I know we have a lot of other issues to get to, but we have to know over this period, and I know a little bit, and I know the degree to which prime ministers interceded, but many countries, it's like Germany, others, that everybody wanted to do this because you get a lot of credit, you know, and you become a player. People wanted to resolve it, including Arabs, including the Jordanians, others, and Mubarak many times. So anybody who thinks that there are easy alternatives to this just doesn't get it.
There's one negotiator who's essentially, and I don't remember his name, it's not in front of me, but there's one person who essentially is being credited with brokering the deal. You know, someone out of Israel who supposedly is very close with Hamas. Is that accurate?
Right. There was a guy, an academic, who supposedly helped the communication, but it was Israeli officials who had to make the decisions. He didn't make decisions. He was just an intermediary.
Right. You always need somebody who could schmooze it up with somebody on the other side, right?
Or has the contact, you know, the open channel.
Right, in order to do so. Tell me about what's happening in the Middle East. In Jordan, King Abdullah said that Egypt could break its peace treaty with Israel. I mean, no surprise to us at this point, because we really don't know what potential future there is between Egypt and Israel at this point. Does that mean, is this setting the stage for possibly even Jordan joining in and eventually breaking their peace treaty with Israel?
The king said no this week, and he was pretty adamant about it. He was just saying that it's a possibility, and I think sounding a warning about the upcoming election. But there's a poll that was done in Egypt just this past week, and it shows the vast majority of them, two-thirds, want to continue the peace agreement. Some say they want to amend it. 27% say they want to continue it as it is. Only 4% say they wanted war, and 7% to abrogate the agreement. So you don't have a mass movement in Egypt despite all the tumult and everything that's going on. It doesn't mean that after the election you might not have some effort to try and remove, let's say, the restrictions on their ability to go into Gaza alone. And they are claiming, the Egyptian military claimed, that they were flying planes over the Sinai without permission of Israel. I don't believe that that's necessarily true. And they certainly asked for permission when they wanted to increase the number of troops there. And Israel saw it in its interest, in the interest of trying to contain the situation, which is out of hand in Gaza, in the Sinai, by allowing them to do it.
Weren't you operating under the assumption that the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt is over at this point?
I never assumed it's over. I believe Egypt can't afford for it to be over, because American aid, which amounts to almost $2 billion a year, is contingent on that. If they abrogate the peace agreement, the aid, which came about as a result of the Camp David Accord, I think would end. And they know it would end. It would also greatly damage their relationship with the United States overall.
The rockets that hit Israel yesterday were from Gaza, correct?
The three rockets came from Gaza. What we have to watch in addition, first of all, we have to know who sent it. It doesn't mean that Hamas was involved, and there are groups there that are trying to undermine them. They supposedly agreed to try to contain it. But what is of concern is to watch to see if the missiles that are firing are the ones that have been smuggled from Libya, higher grade, you know, Russian supplied. There are tens of thousands of Scholz-Fraim missiles, which could bring down planes, et cetera, that are on the market in Libya that disappeared from the huge stockpiles that of Gaddafi that were opened up, and individuals were seen, you know, walking around carrying huge stockpiles of weapons. They've been selling them. The Egyptians in one night captured five small convoys going to Gaza where they're sold, and it doesn't mean that they necessarily and stay in Gaza. They can be sold to other terrorist groups. They can be sold to you know, anybody with the cash to pay for it.
Unbelievable. The Elan grapple deal yesterday with Egypt, so 25 prisoners were exchanged. Now, how do we rank these types of prisoners?
These are not high security cases. They were serious. They were, some of them were criminal activities, but the getting grapple back was considered a priority.
Right. And why does it's so strange, because it seems like Egypt is going in this direction of, you know, Islamic radicalism, and that's what we're going to see specifically after the election. Yet at the same time, they're sort of still dealing with Israel, and there's still someone to talk to.
Well, first of all, it's the generals that are in control still, and that is not changing right away, and it may not change for quite a while. They're even trying, now there are demonstrations against the generals, because the feeling is that they're trying to extend their control. The presidential election is, I think I said here before the Yom Tovim, would not, I believe, take place for a year, maybe more.
Right.
That right now you'll have the parliamentary elections, so the generals are still in control in Egypt, and Egypt can't allow some of these things to take place. The Muslim Brotherhood, playing it smart as they do everywhere, looking to gain control but not responsibility to play a key role. They always put the face of moderation. We see it in Tunis today, and how everybody falls for the same trap that they fell with in regard to Turkey. And the American government's pushing Turkey as the model, you know, to see Erdogan. It can be an Islamist. It can be pro-West. He's not pro-West. He's an Islamist. He's moving in more and more extreme directions. He's working inside Arab countries and Muslim countries. He's trying to do exactly what Iran does. He's competing with Iran at the same time that he is cooperating with Iran. And people who think that the Muslim parties, you have the Ghannouchi in Tunisia, who's exactly the same thing as Khomeini, and the same thing as Erdogan, and they put on the face of moderation because the Tunisian people generally are moderate, so they don't feel threatened by it, they don't feel that they're going to impose Sharia law, but as soon as they're in a position to do it, they'll start moving slowly in that direction. The same thing with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, didn't participate in the demonstrations very visibly, played a back bench role, and as soon as they needed to move, they move ahead and take this more assertive role. And you know exactly what the goal is, and there are growing linkages between these Muslim movements. So, the Independence Party, this Anat Party, was directly linked to the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. It was created in 79 after the Iranian Revolution, when on many campuses or universities around the Muslim world, they started organizing groups a la Khomeini they engaged in terrorist activities. They blew up hotels. I mean, this is the image of this moderate, quote, entity that emerges.
Turkey is harboring anti-Assad fighters. This is going to be an escalation of the Turkish-Syrian problem?
Yes, and it's not just Turkey. There are hundreds and hundreds of defectors from the Syrian army. Many of them are living in the Lebanese border. Syria has beefed up its troops there to stop them from moving across. Hezbollah also patrols the border now, but they also, many tens of thousands of people have gone to Turkey. Turkey has escalated in the time we haven't talked, the rhetoric and some of the military exercises vis-a-vis Syria. Their goal had been to impose a Muslim Brotherhood on to get a third of the seats and when of the government of Syria for the Muslim Brotherhood, and when Assad refused, that's when they turned on him, even though it has affected their relationship with Iran, whom they now have love-hate-hate-hate relationship, meaning that they cooperate because it benefits them financially to be the way Iran can avoid the sanctions, doing the banking through them, trade through them, other things. That at the same time, the Sunni-Shiite competition, the attempts to extend their sphere of influence, one to create the Ottoman Empire, one to create the Persian Empire, which I've talked about and warned about, as you know, for a long time. We see it coming into play. I met this week with a head of one a Muslim country, and when he started telling me about the activities of both Iran and Turkey inside his country, which is a moderate pro-Western country, I mean, you see the degree to which this competition is extending, and it goes to both trying to visit Egypt, both getting the message from Egypt, we're not interested in Ottomans, and we're not interested in a Persian takeover.
Well, one thing we've learned, or observed, that Turkey's arsenal is larger than I think, because they're taking on the big boys. I mean,
Turkey is a very powerful country. Look, it's 70 million people, as is Iran. They have they're members of NATO. They have huge stockpiles of weapons, including stuff Israel sold to them. So, you know, you have to take Turkey very seriously. It's not a small country.
Right.
And that when you add to it this ideological drive, this extremist ideological drive, you have another component that really is very important. And Erdogan is an Islamist, and he doesn't make a secret of it. And those who knew him when he was a mayor of Ankara many years ago told me about his being evil then and being evil now. And we see, look at the way he's going after the Kurds, bombing them, killing them. All of a sudden, the same guy who criticized Israel for defending itself is able to go after a terrorist group and use indiscriminate bombing, killing civilians, going into Iraq across an international border with impunity.
Yeah, they're flexing their muscles, and it looks like that he could actually back it up. Was there or was there not a request from the United States to Israel this week for a settlement freeze?
I do not know of a request for a settlement freeze. The United States has always had a consistent position against settlements, against construction, criticizes it whenever it comes up, whether it's part of Jerusalem or not. We don't see the distinction being made. We see no... So this has been a consistent policy that goes back not just in this administration and previous administration.
Well, the rumor was that Dan Shapiro put in this request, and it was rejected by...
I saw those reports, and I just can't confirm it. I have not, in any discussions that I've had with people this week, heard that this was a specific request. It is true that Germany has made such a request, and the United States has often requested it. Hillary Clinton said it publicly. They wanted to do it because they wanted something more for Abbas in order to get him back to the table, because they're now working the quartet has drafted a position which actually was closer to Israel's position, and Israel again accepted that as a basis for negotiations. The Palestinians again have so far rejected it, although the feeling is that now there's a 90-day period and both sides will submit papers on the territory and security issues, and they hope that after this 90-day period, then they're required to come into direct negotiation.
Right. And one of the things tossed around was a silent freeze. Now, how does that work? They inform the other side that there's really a freeze and pray they don't go to the media with it? Is that how it works?
Israel has done it all along. There's no new settlements being constructed. There works construction freezes. Ask people who want to try and get a building permit in the West Bank.
I know, but officially there's no freeze now.
Just as people who want to build, whether there's how difficult it is and what the restrictions are, and any construction that goes on is only within the existing footprint and within built-up areas. It's not new areas. But the settlements represent 1.7% of the territory, 6% of all the West Bank, of everything is behind the fence. So the 94% outside, 40%, 60% of all of the West Bank is unoccupied. Nobody living there. So all these images about the construction and about what this means and the numbers are, you know, you have to look at it in context. This is seen as a critical issue. It's become the whipping post for Israel. There are a lot of people who feel that Israel, you know, should try to accommodate it and deal with it. But Israel had. They had a 10-month freeze, and Abbas did nothing.
Is it true that Muammar Gaddafi had close ties with certain high-profile Israelis and high-profile Jews from around the world?
I don't know. I don't want to know.
Multiple media sources claim that there was a...
Yeah, but everybody's going to claim everything. And, you know, there are always all sorts of rumors. There were rumors, you know, that this one is Jewish and that this Arab leader came from Jews. Ahmadinejad, Gaddafi, others. And I don't think you should put too much stock in it. Given all the really serious issues, I don't have time to pursue all of
Well, I think if it's true that Gaddafi wanted a better secret relationship with the United States and tried to use Jews and Israelis to intervene, I think that's interesting.
No, I didn't say it's not interesting, but I said at this point it's speculative.
Right.
Because, you know, you haven't seen people come forward. When we start seeing the round of books and all these authors come to you to be interviewed, then you'll get a better picture.
Let's hope. Gaddafi's end in Libya. So who does get credit for eliminating him?
I guess the guy who pulled the trigger, but, you know, they found him. Certainly none of this would have happened without the NATO intervention. And the bombings, you saw that, you know, that it was a NATO plane that hit the convoy he was in.
Right.
Then they ran into these drainage pipes, and he was hiding in there.
Is it complete bedlam now in Libya?
Libya itself, again, like Syria, like some Yemen, it's not a real country. So it breaks down then into many groups. But look at what the leadership, the current leader, Jalili, who's the temporary interim leader, Mustafa Jalil, what he said. He said, we're going to introduce Sharia law. And that would be Libya's principal law.
Right.
And any law that violates it, including polygamy and other things, are going to be null and void, which is the words he used. And there's a lot of concern among some of the more moderate elements. You don't have any coherence there. And wait till we see what will happen in elections. Tunisia, which was a much more moderate country, more educated population, no history of really radical Islam to the degree that we've seen in other places, you see there already how this is emerging. And Ghannouchi, who, as I said before, has returned, will put on the face of moderation. But believe me, that mask will be removed.
Right. I don't understand if Gaddafi, if Libya and Syria, for instance, as you just mentioned, so if they're not real countries, so to speak, if they don't have the unity and the, you know, a working relationship between groups that you would need in a unified country, how do these guys stay in dictatorial positions for so many decades?
Because that's how they can rule is by being dictators, trying to cobble together, let's say in Syria's case, Sunni, Shiites, Quranis, Alawites, others, and he, of course, put Alawites, because he is one and the only one he could trust, and some Sunnis and a few Christians into key positions because he knew the minorities would be be more loyal, even though we're seeing some breakdown in that. But the Christians and certainly the Alawites have largely remained loyal to him. So, and Gaddafi, the same thing. You have 40 tribes. You have, you know, vast differences. And some of the leaders who are emerging are not good guys. These are guys who were al-Qaeda. These are guys who were involved in terrorist activities. And let's see what they are able to do. Egypt, as we see, which is facing an election coming up very soon, the parliamentary election that is coming, you see the degree to which the Muslim Brotherhood is emerging as a critical power. And, you know, its economic situation is terrible. But the army is, again, asserting itself. The same army that wanted to get out of this earlier now is looking, it appears, to prolong its control, because they also control a lot of the economy and they have a lot of vested interests. But I think that they recognize that this thing will disintegrate with Hamas and with the Muslim Brotherhood being the only organized party and having the infrastructure of the mosques and others to be able to recruit. So I think there's a lot of reassessment going on in each of these countries, and we'll have to see. Nobody can judge what the outcome will be at this point. You don't know until we really put it to the test. But as I told you about the history of the Ennahda, the party, when you know their background, that these could be just wolves in sheep's clothing.
Right. What do you make of the bump that Likud got in the polls after the Shalit deal?
Nothing. It's expected.
It is expected?
Yeah.
Why? Because the
because it was pop people wanted it.
No, but I understand. But meaning that that those who are, you know, essentially undecided or who straddle the fence politically, they move to the right.
But it's a temporary bump. This will correct, as you see with our candidates. You know, something happens, they go up, they go down. It's Israel's democracy. People react to a particular event. People felt good. they felt that Netanyahu showed leadership. Whether they, even those who disagreed, at least had to acknowledge it, so it helps him temporarily, but none of this stuff is sustained.
Israel acquiesced and submitted border proposals to the quartet. Is this the first time? Is this unusual? This always goes on.
Well, they haven't really submitted. They submitted some ideas, but they now are required to submit. Both sides are being asked to submit their ideas and their proposals for consideration. They have 90 days to do it.
Is Israel going to set the bar a little too high?
Well, they always want to set it high because you're going to always be asked.
I mean high the other way. I mean against the home line rule. Are they going to set it to a point where it shouldn't start the negotiations?
That is a good question. We'll have to see. I hope they learned the lessons from past negotiations. But every time it is said that everybody knows what the solution will look like, then you've taken away Israel's bargaining position. And the essence of negotiations is give and take, but you can't give when you start off
right,
giving everything in the initial position.
And if they're going to do what they usually...
And you have a lot of other things that will affect it in the coming weeks. You know, the application we expect Abbas to pursue at the Security Council, I think around November 11th, will have a vast impact if he, in fact, is able to get the 9 votes. And we know that Gabon, currently a member of the Security Council, has switched to say that they will support a unilateral declaration.
Oh, boy.
And as I explained, they need 9 votes.
Right.
I think that they have 8 now. There's one country I won't mention because I don't want to be subject to more pressure that is really the swing. And so far, I met with the president this week, and I hope that they will hold out. But they're under immense pressure. And you've had an election where we have new countries that will be coming in September. Brazil, Nigeria, Bosnia, Gabon, and Lebanon will be out. And Azerbaijan just won the European seat away from Slovenia, along with Guatemala and the others, Togo, Morocco, will be coming into, and Pakistan will be coming into this Security Council. So I don't think it benefits him, and I think that he will push for it. He will also push the UNESCO application. And the reason why, again, is that if he gets recognition from these groups, he will be able to go to the International Criminal Court and claim that he can then has the recognition that enables him to bring all the lawsuits and war crimes charges against Israelis. UNESCO is important because U.S. law says that if, in fact, they recognize it, or any U.N. agency accepts a non-state member, they will lose the funding. The United States gives 22% or 21% of the budget of UNESCO. France, which all along had been pushing it, Sarkozy, had favored this, gives 6%, and all of a sudden he's facing this reality that almost a quarter of the budget is going to disappear.
Right.
They're trying. Why? Because they say the law, people in the administration have argued that the law says if they admit it as a member state, and they're going to see if they can come up with some formulation that just admits them as a member, but without declaring the state, saying therefore the law isn't activated. I will tell you there are a lot of people in Congress who will not buy that and who will want to see it. But you remember UNESCO has a history already on Rachel's Tomb, and we've talked about it, mm-hmm. Machpelah, other places where they have come out, sympathetic to the Palestinian position about Kibbutz Rachel, Rachel's Tomb being a mosque, and, challenging Israel's claims to the Jewish nature and exclusive Jewish nature of these places that were so critical to Jewish history. But the UN could be the platform right now for events that would make negotiations virtually impossible. And Abbas seems committed to pursuing this. He doesn't have any alternative, and I don't think he wants really negotiations. He wants to be able to say this is his legacy he delivered. And the events there are going to be very critical. People have to watch this, and we maybe call on them to intercede. Business people who do business in the countries I mentioned, like Gabon or Bosnia or Lebanon, not Lebanon, Lebanon's locked in, Nigeria, to help persuade them, because the Arabs, and particularly the Palestinians, sending delegations to all these places, Israel as well, to pressure them.
To be continued. Malcolm, thanks so much. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Malcolm Hohnlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Weekly update.